I would recognize her name, but I don't know it. Who's that one? Let's give it to the net first. You're going to have to tell us that one, Paul.
Kathy Thornton. They call her KT. She was also on that Hubble service repair mission. And she was the one that launched that solar panel from the Hubble and let it fly off. And you watched it go off into the distance. Eventually, that burnt up in the atmosphere. That was quite a scene when they had that.
Okay. Let me go back to Mel for a second now. Mel, did you get a chance to cover whatever email you think you should cover? And did you get a chance to tell us what your particular group of guys have been doing this week? And I hope you've been building a fire under them. I hope they're as active this week as they were last week. Mel, go ahead.
Yeah, this is KTKEY. Well, mostly I've been experimenting this past week. It's something somewhat interesting with the loop, my receiving loop. Thursday night, with the loop aimed towards, basically peaked towards the signal coming from the west, there was a severe amount of noise, so bad that I could not have a QSO with my friends out that way because there's a lot of thunderstorm activity. So it was around midnight, and I said, well, take one peek around, and I just happened to look up at the scope, and I saw a signal pop up about 10 kilohertz lower. So I tuned over to that signal, and sure enough, somebody was calling ZQ from South Carolina. So I came back to him, and I turned the loop, and I peeked the loop on him. And believe it or not, on my receiving loop, I had no QR Nancy, just about completely nulled out. If I switched over back listening with my transmitting loop, the one wavelength loop, the noise level was ferocious. Besides man-made noise, which I'm always getting, the noise that was static, that was being generated from the thunderstorms out west was tremendous. They're big bursts. I mean, it was terrible. You just want to shut the thing off. It was so bad. But amazing with the receiving loop, just literally didn't hear it at all. I was so amazed that when I peaked the signal to the south, down towards the south, that it completely would null out something as I would think be that strong. Would be generated by thunderheads, take over.
Fantastic. And I got two questions for you. When you're doing that peaking, were you peaking for the maximum signal strength from the guy in South Carolina, or were you peaking for the maximum signal-to-noise ratio? That's question number one. Because I ran into somebody on the air this week, and I started quoting what I think you've been doing with your receiving loop by comparison to the full wave loop out in the backyard, up in the air, and how much better reception you're getting on the relatively small, multi-turn, internal loop inside the house, where you can easily tilt it in as and L, and therefore peak. So here's my second question. Have you done any significant amount of transmitting yet? I know it's a little hard to do it because being close to you, and you don't want to transmit that close, but maybe there's a way you can set it up across the room and pull on ropes so you can tune it in azimuth and elevation by pulling on the ropes, and I'd love to see you retune the loop when you transmit through it with the guy in Pennsylvania, for instance, feeding back to you over the telephone signal strength. Because you're on HF frequencies, you've got significant polarization reciprocity failure. In other words, the Faraday rotation, when the signal goes through the ionosphere from east to west, is very different than when it comes from west to east. So I'm relatively sure most of the time the tuning of the loop in the transmit mode will be significantly different than the receive mode. But when you do transmit into it, I am predicting that your loop properly tuned for transmit, the internal loop in the house, will do better than the full loop out in the backyard, full wave loop out in the backyard. So those are two questions for you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, let's put it this way. No, I have not transmitted on it. for the fact that this loop is jammed into the room with me, and if you see what's going on in there now, it's, as they say, I need a wall stretcher, and I can't spill out anywhere out of that room. That is a surety. So I have not put RF into it. However, as far as how do I tune the loop, remember, this is two loops I have inside. It is a loop inside of a loop. The main loop, the receiving, the main receiving loop is 12 feet in what you want to call circumference, actually 3 feet on the side. You know, it's standing up on end like a diamond. In other words, it looks like a diamond looking from home plate. A baseball field down, you would be, you visualize what the loop looks like, and around the edge it stretched this piece of coax, and I went through this before. It's got the variable condenser where you tune it at the home plate would be. Sits on a tripod, a camera tripod, which of course I can turn and twist, you know, and do all kinds of manipulations with it. Now, inside this main loop, I built another frame that is half the size. It's 18 inches on each part of the diamond, or a total of 6 feet, based on the same principle with the variable on the bottom. And it's suspended inside there on rod on a wooden, wooden points, one on the top of the diamond, one down in the bottom towards home plate. And so I can independently turn that. Now what happens is, what I do, I go into this gadget that I have, which is a QRN squasher. Basically, it uses two inputs, one for your receiving antenna and one for the, normally for your noise antenna. I readapted this thing and modified it. And then I peak the 12-foot circumference one on the signal, and then I switch over. I turn the switch, which switches the antenna now, switches the small one on to the main line now, and I take that. Now I go back to the other position, and what I do is I turn now the loop, the small loop, towards and peak the noise source. Once I peak the noise source, I then set the QRN squash, I phase the noise down, and of course I get then a degrading in the signal level. So then I go into a Q multiplier, and I find with the Q multiplier, of course I can get a very high dynamic range, better than 100 dBs, with approximately around a 10 volt dB gain. So that's basically the layout of this system, Dick, and I've looked through books and all. I've seen references to, you know, receiving loops, but nothing has gone this far with it. As far as transmitting, I don't know. You can't easily. I guess I'd have to disconnect the loop from the system and run it independently, you know, to transmit on it. The only thing is, like I say, it's very congested in that room. I have to have the RF sitting about no more than 2 foot away from me, or less than that. It's really on top of me. Over.
Okay, there's a beautiful solution coming up, Mel. As the warmer days come, with a nice extension cord, you can bring your transmitter, your receiver, and your loop out into the backyard. I've seen your house from an aerial picture. You've got enough room there on Dover Street that you can put the loop in the backyard. You can put it 5 feet away from you, and by ropes and pulleys, you can steer it in azimuth and elevation. And I'd love to see what you can do on transmitting. We now know that when a signal arrives into your backyard, into your QTH, it arrives at a particular polarization, a particular angle of the ionosphere, depending on the state of the ionosphere and the state of the Earth's magnetic field that particular day. And that's a variable. And that's part of the explanation why you get selective fading. You can hear a guy, back in the old days when we heard AM, you would hear it sound like Donald Duck periodically when the carrier got nulled out with the selective fading. So the medium is very complicated. There's all kinds of bouncing going on, multiple signal reception, and so on. So the ability to have the loop which can be tuned for the direction of arrival and the polarization of the direction of arrival, I'm convinced is a fantastic advantage. And although your loop may be kind of narrow band, still with some care of the components involved, I think you can transmit into it. And when you then do the tuning in the transmit mode, which will be a little bit different than the receiving mode, I think, and you have it fed back to you by telephone, into your cell phone, so to speak, it's going to be a fascinating experiment. I think you could do that in the backyard later on this spring. What do you think, Mel?
Yeah, I've been tempted to try as a transmitting antenna and see what the comparison would be between, you know, first of all, you know, when I describe this to anybody and I tell them that I get a full wavelength loop outside at 45 feet up, at 272 feet of wire, and fed with open wire feeders into the Johnson kilowatt matchbox and the whole business and all, and I said, yep, but I hear better on my 0.1 wavelength loop. And they said, what did you say, 0.1 wavelength? Oh, I've had discussions on 75 meters about this. What do you mean by less than 0.1 wavelength? And I tell them what it is. And they said, and you hear it all on that? I said, I hear better in most cases. I have directivity. You can't have no directivity with it. I said, oh boy, do I have directivity. I can turn it null, literally null the signal out. I can take a 5-9 signal and get it down to literally to nothing. Can't be. Can't happen. This can't. And that's it. So I'm wondering, you know, of course, the problem is, what will happen with the variable condenser? I'm using just a salvage broadcast radio variable condenser as my tuning condenser down the bottom. You know, what'll happen if it'll hold any kind of appreciable power. Not only that, I did blow out the Q multiplier about a week ago, and the only thing I can think of that killed the transistor, the MOSFET in there, the transistor and the amplifier transistor, the only thing I can think of is running a kilowatt and with a resonant loop right next to it, Dick, that I think it had concentrated enough energy into that Q multiplier circuit, and I put in a different transistor, a shielded type. Oh, I did a whole again modification. But I was wondering, I hesitated to put power into this thing even at all in the shack over.
Yeah, I can see where you're going with this one. The transistor you blew out, I agree with you. I think I see what blew it out. And usually it's a Radio Shack replacement, so that's not, there's a substitute FET transistor, and so fixing that's not too bad. When you do transmit back into the loop antenna that you're receiving on, and using a broadcast variable 365 microfarad variable capacitor, we'll say, it reminds me of my 6-meter half-kilowatt transmitter, a 4CX250B with 2 kilovolts on the plate. It can produce a healthy 500 watts, and I would arc over its air variable capacitor, which was a wide-spaced transmitting type, and eventually ended up putting slabs of Teflon in between the plates of the capacitor to stop the arc over, by which I discovered there's Teflon and there's Teflon. In a case like that, you've got to choose virgin Teflon, which doesn't have pinholes. The cheap Teflon you can get a hold of is reprocessed, and it's got pinholes, and the pinholes allow the arcing to happen all over again. So what I've discovered is that when you arc over a capacitor in transmitting, it's annoying. It makes some black spots depending on how much power you're running and how long you do it. But in general, it is not destructive. It's an easily repairable thing. So you could, if you want to, slowly sneak up in power until you do or don't arc up over the capacitor. And even if, for whatever reason, you can't get beyond 30 watts without arcing something over, there's nothing stopping you from running QRP on transmit once you establish a QSO with the guy. And maybe you're going to be doing CW key down in order to tune the loop to peak the signal. And even if you're only transmitting 1 watt, you'll still find out very rapidly what the transmitting characteristics are. The reason why so many people are skeptical when you tell them a tenth of a wavelength loop, everyone assumes with good common sense that a tenth of a wavelength loop must have a smaller effective capture area. Absolutely, positively not. You read the appropriate chapter of infinitesimal dipole in the Bible, antennas by Krauss or the appropriate chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you'll find out that once you resonate the antenna, the physical size of the antenna does not matter. You have the exact same effective capture area. Of course, that doesn't make common sense. But once you think about the fact that a full half-wave dipole has the signal bouncing back and forth 30 times in a coherent manner, every bounce is identical, and they all add up. That's how the dipole radiates. And you make an infinitesimal dipole, or you make a small tenth of a wavelength loop, that signal is bouncing around there, not 30 times, 300 or 3,000 times. With all of those coherent bounces, you come right back to the same effective capture area on transmit and on receive. Obvious by the fact it's got the exact same pattern and the exact same gain. And lots of good books on that. A couple of the latest issues of Antennas and Propagation Journal, or Proceedings. I've been a 35-year member of Antennas and Propagation. I got some damn good articles lately on dipoles and infinitesimal dipoles and small antennas and whatever. I mean, you would think, since Hertz did his dipole experiments something like 1885, and here we are 123 to 22 years later redeveloping brand new techniques for a dipole. You take a look at the December issue of Antennas and Propagation 2006, there's a brand new breakthrough in dipoles. Identical gain, but the guy has managed to increase the bandwidth from 3% to over 50%. Fantastic. And I'm the guy who a year and a half ago patented a brand new Yagi antenna. And that was invented in 1927, 1928. So you ain't heard the end of the story yet. So even if you only transmit QRP into the backyard, which makes it even a lot more safer as far as RF biohazard is concerned, I'm looking forward to when you transmit. And I think I know what you're going to find. And I think there's a 80% chance you're going to primarily abandon the 45-foot high full wavelength loop in the backyard to some degree. K2KEY. By the way, what the hell got you started on these loop antennas? What triggered that? You should have known it wasn't going to work. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, what started me on it? Years ago, a good friend of mine, Cliff, who now is the owner of AEA, Advanced Electronics, he got started on this business with loops, and he was manufacturing the loop. And then there was a whole business with the company. They sold out to Swan, and he bought it back, and blah, 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 blah. And they, in the interim, they stopped making the loops, and then they went back to making them and all, and then, of course, they sold out the jigs they had and all to another company and all. And somebody that I knew had bought one of them, and he brought it up to me, and he said to me, I don't know if this thing has much use and everything. And I went through the whole thing, telling him how it works and all. And then I said, we did homebrew a transmitting version. I think I told you about that when we put together with copper pipe. And instead of using a tuning capacitor, we just had two pieces of copper pipe that were that moved next to each other like a piston fashion, not a parallel fashion, with plastic screw rods. And that was taken to New York. My friend used it in New York in a high-rise there out on his patio deck. I told you he sprayed it black and everything after he soldered. We partially soldered it together in the place and all, and made it all out of a 3/4-inch water pipe, copper water pipe, and silver soldered it, the whole thing together, because, I could say the joints are very critical for resistance. So anyway, he says to me, this guy that has the AEA version, he says, I'm receiving on this thing, and he says, it receives fantastically well at night on 75 meters. I says, really? He says, you say 75 meters, very noisy. He says, boy, he says, I can get some real good reception on this thing. So, that sort of piqued my curiosity all over again, Dick. And I said, you know, because 75 meters is a rough bend at night, especially during the holiday season with all those Christmas decorations flashing away. For some reason, a number of them, I guess, the contact with these flashes and all create a heck of a lot of hash. So that's how I came up with, you know, the idea of getting involved again, looking into the loops a little bit more closely. I sort of forgot about it for a number of years. And as I got deeper into it, I came up with more and more ideas. But the problem with 75 meters is, number one, during the daytime, if I had to conduct an experiment, I'd have to do it during the daytime because I don't think I should go out there and fool around at night. With the, not that it's not safe here or anything like that, but I think they may just call the police, something strange going on in the backyard there. And also at night on 75 meters, it seems like if you don't run a kilowatt on 75 meters, you're just not heard, Dick, over.
Yeah, but you've seen the way the reception on that full loop in the backyard at times was a significant number of dB lower than what you get with the internal loop in the house. Everything I know about the law of reciprocity tells me that by whatever means, however your antenna operates on transmit, on receive, it operates the exact same way on transmit, as long as you don't arc something over with the higher power of transmitting versus reception. So where you're getting a significant number of dB of improvement on the internal loop when it's properly tuned, and ASL and polarization and whatever, and Q multiplying and so on, that on transmission, you've got to get the exact same performance. And it's an improved performance. It's a significant number of dB of improvement. I think you're going to find band openings that people thought they could only find if they're using that Japanese guy's five-element, full-size, 80-meter Yagi that fills up the whole roof of a huge apartment building. People think that's the only thing that's going to get through at the bad times on 80 meters. And I think you're going to find some pleasant surprises once you start transmitting with this thing. You also realize, Mel, that because what you're doing, it's a darn different from common sense. You know you're in the process of writing an article on this, a significant article. It's going to blow people's minds. Let's hope that they don't publish it on the April issue because somebody will think it's a nut paper until they find out enough of the real stuff of what's going on that this is real. This is not phony. It defies normal human logic about antennas. And when it comes to a microphone, you got to look at it as an area relationship when you want to figure out how much acoustic noise it absorbs. When it comes to an antenna, you got to look at it from an area relationship. None of the books are written that way. None of the courses are taught that way. Everything I do with antennas as a profession is looking at the antenna from an area relationship. Every one of the antennas I work on, I calculate the effective capture area, and I figure out what objects do I have in that area that are contaminating it, and there's ways that I can modify the stuff that's contaminating that area so I can still get the 80% performance out of the antenna. You've got to look at the area of these things. And so that loop of yours, you don't look at it with your eyes to figure out your area. You look at it with a radio eye. In other words, once it resonates, and once you know it's in dB over isotropic, you can predict exactly how many square meters of area it must have. And I don't care if you've got a tenth of a wavelength thing there. A dipole, every full-size half-wave dipole, has 0.13 lambda squared area. At 80 meters, that turns out to be 8,500 square feet. You're a little bit down from full dipole. You're not 2.14. You're a little bit closer to isotropic. You're 1.76. The infinitesimal dipole is 1.76. And if I recalculate the number, it's not that 8,500. Maybe it's 7,900. You've got 7,900 square feet of effective area in that loop. Of course, you can't see it with your eye, radio-wise. As long as the wire is lossless, that's what the area must be. Ain't that a mind blower? K2KUR and K2LIW.
WS2N for a comment.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. When I speak to Mel on 80, you know, I'm out east. I'm out in Ronkonkoma, Suffolk County. And most of the times there's another guy on. He's in Pittsburgh. I think that's what George is. That's the other direction. So Mel can't hear me when he's talking, and then when I come on, he moves his antenna around. And that's the only thing that's really weird about it. In the beginning, he was going nuts, but now he's able to find it real quick, and now I don't even really notice the difference when he passes it back to me. So I just wanted to make a comment about that. It does work good for some reason. I only run the 100 watt, and when he hears me, he hears me good. One other comment, by the way. I don't know if I said Kathy Sullivan or not. Kathy Sullivan, the first U.S. woman to walk in space back in 1984. Back to you, Dick.
And what was the name of the craft she was on?
I was also a Challenger. I had to double-check that in my book. I was also a Challenger, and it was the first time two women were on board at the same time. She was on board with Sally Ride as well. So there you go. Back to you.
I should know that Sally Ride passed away, I think, during the Columbia disaster.
Oh, no. She's still around. She's teaching physics or something out in California. What's the name of that college that Clinton's daughter went to? Scranton? Oh, I don't know. That big famous college out there. No, she's doing good. She wasn't. That was Judy Resnick, was on board with Krista McCall on Challenger when that thing blew up back in the day.
Okay. And the lady that we lost in the Columbia disaster, the Indian lady, I can't think of her name.
I got offhand, Dick, not that quick lately. Another seven astronauts. Both of them were seven astronauts. That was the one you had the first guy from Israel up there. I'll think of her name in a minute. That would come to me later. But I wanted to comment about the 80-meter deal with Mel. Back to you, Dave.
KB2.
KB2.
I got it. KB2, YEW.
Mel, you realize you're writing an article, and it's going to be a significant article. It's probably not going to come out for a year, but once you start transmitting, I think you're about to find a mind blow there, Mel.
And another station just called it KB2YEW. Yes, we'll get to it. Well, I put it all together eventually into some kind of a order. Maybe if you like, I send you the whole thing and you can... I'm sure you'd know better how to word it up correctly, because I'll go around in circles and, like you say, they'll think it's an April Fool's joke if I put it together. Yes, there was one or two more comments I was going to make on it. I don't know how to also to distinguish her. Let's pick up the other station first. I forgot, I was hearing, I got one email here I forgot to get to, but I don't know how to distinguish between what is, in the realm of amateur radio, what is the realm of crossing over, like, into your field, Dick. But I'll explain further. First, let's see, KB2, was it YEW? This is KEY, the TechNet.
Yes, good evening. Count me in as a late check-in. I've been listening just about all night. Didn't want to interrupt, and that's been great tonight. And, Dick, I finally found that TBI problem. Found and cured.
Hey, Guy, that's a success story. I think it's time to give us a few more details. You got the floor, sir.
Well, as you know, it started out with a homebrew circular polarized satellite antenna. The 2-meter uplink was destroying only several TVs. My little 13-inch shop in my shack, nothing. My DLT in my bedroom, nothing. And when I went downstairs to pop my projection TV screen, it destroyed it. Well, I tried grounding and everything, and obviously that did absolutely nothing. Talking to a couple of different people, I found an MFJ dual band antenna tuner. They since stopped making them. I found one and I ended up buying it. I went to actually call in England for it, and England was out of stock, MFJ was out of stock, but I found somebody who bought one, brand new, bought it. Worked somewhat well. Somebody had an antique piece of equipment. Says it was a variable filter for 130 to about 130 to 150 megahertz. Bought that, put it in line with it, took a lot of tuning on both sides, and I got it down to, I could get it down to zero, where you don't hear absolutely nothing coming out of the TV, but I'm at a loss of power. I got it down to, I could transmit full power. You have to put the TV into the mute position and put your ear up against the speaker to hear anything with the two systems in line. The one question that I do have is, on my MFJ antenna tuner, it's a dual band antenna tuner, 2 meter 440. I tuned it in properly, everything worked great. I figured that the 440 portion of it would have no effect. When I did tune the tuning, the tuning capacitors on the 440 side, it had a major effect on the 2 meter side. I was just wondering why.
It does sound like there's some cross coupling. The third harmonic of 2 meters is 440. That's a contributing factor. So even if they are completely separate circuits, because they're located in the same box, when you resonate the 440, maybe it emphasizes the third harmonic of 2 meters that you're trying to reject. But that's a guess. And depending on how the design works, maybe those tuning controls for 440 are not thoroughly disconnected. They're still partially connected when you're in the 2 meter mode. So you have to study the schematic or open up the box and physically look at things in order to figure that one out. So if I understand you correctly, when you properly tune this filter, this antenna tuner, and yes, antenna tuners for 2 meters and 440 are rare animals. People just haven't discovered them up there, and they haven't developed a faith in the goodness of antenna tuners. So if I understand correctly, you apparently were adjusting this thing while watching the downstairs set or whichever set gets heavily interfered with. And by tuning the filter, you were able to eliminate the TVI. It does suggest that the transmitter was putting out a frequency that was improper. Modern day transmitters, though, have some darn good filters that's not supposed to allow that to happen. Refresh my memory, Guy. What kind of a transmitter were you using?
I'm using the Kenwood TS-2000. On vertical, I get absolutely zero. Zero TVI. Now we're talking about, we're talking about satellite TV, and it's not the TV. It's definitely the front end of the TV. It's not the reception of the cable or the satellite.
Understand. So it does sound like there's an improper frequency there coming out of that 2000. That's such a modern rig, that's amazing. But the fact that you're able to eliminate it with a filter and still get... You have reason to believe that on the output end of the filter, most of your transmit power is still there. Did you get a chance to check that one, Guy?
Yeah, I did check that one. If I rejected that I could only get out, say, for argument's sake, 100, instead of the 100 watts, get out 80, you won't even hear a whisper out of the TV. But if I let it put out its 100 watts with the watt meter after it and tune between that and the tuner, tune it properly and put the watt meter after the whole thing, put the watt meter right before the antenna and let it put out the 100, you have to put your ear up against the speaker. If I may, I would love to switch over to the satellite antenna and see if you hear me.
Okay, that's your choice. If it doesn't take too long, go right ahead.
Okay, we're transmitting on basically a horizontal polarized antenna right now.
And I'm hearing you on the input, you sound good, and I'm hearing you through the repeater, you sound good.
Okay, and the SWR is a little higher. Okay, it's a little bit higher, it's about a 1.6, 1.7, and I'm still putting out the same amount of power, and I'm still drawing the same current on my power supply.
And now flip back to the other antenna guy.
Okay, I'm back over on the vertical. I'm on the diamond right now. The diamond is about 15 feet higher than the omnial directional.
The signal strength I'm getting in Huntington from both antennas are within a dB of each other, and I can't tell which one is higher because the aircraft are flying over, and I'm seeing some QSB in there. So that antenna's flying. And, boy, that filter did it.
Dick, I'm in my car, and I just got to mention that gentleman direct is really loud on his vertical and really low on his horizontal. Just thought I'd mention that.
That's probably the way it should be, Barry. I presume you're using a vertically polarized antenna from your automobile. Is that true, Mr. Barris?
Yes, vertically polarized for sure.
And I'm using an antenna that's slant 45 degrees in polarization, so therefore I get both of his antennas with identical power. Hey, guy, that is working. And how did you know to buy that filter? How many dollars did it cost you? And that's quite a leap of faith that you bought the filter and it solved the problem. I wouldn't have predicted that one. I thought a modern-day rig couldn't do that. Back to you, guy.
Okay, I went on eBay, searched around, and brought up filters and put in ham radio equipment. Up pops this website of ComAire, C-O-M-A-I-R-E, with a model number of CF2. And I emailed the guy back. And I asked him what type of filter was this, low band, high band. I told him the problem I had was having TVI. He told me it's not a plug and play filter, but it's definitely what I'm looking for. It's made to pass 130 to I think about 150 megahertz. And with the variable tuning capacitor at the top, it's made to reject the TVI. Well, I waited till the bidding went down to a minute, and only one person bidded on it. I threw a bid out there, and I got it for $10, which was amazing. I figured for $10 plus another, I think it was $8 shipping, so it's $18, I'll just roll the dice. This thing came to the house, and it had a scratch on the paint. So I looked through the scratch, and I couldn't figure out exactly what it was. I said, you know what, I want to ground this piece of equipment, so let me take the cover of it. I took it apart. I said, let me take the cover of it off so I could grind down the paint a little on my wire wheel so I could put a nice ground connection on it. Turns out the whole thing is made out of solid copper. It's a solid copper case. I don't know how old this thing is. It looks pretty old, but let me tell you, it works. It works, and it's worth more in Mongo than the $18 that I paid for it.
Well done. Is that a homebrew or is that a commercially made product, guy?
No, it's a commercial made product. It says ComAire. I'm looking at it right now. ComAire, C-O-M-A-I-R-E. I have a model number of CF2. I have, under the ComAire, I have three planes and a tower with an antenna on top of the tower, and that's their insignia. Three look like jet aircraft. I don't know if it's made for aviation. It's a little high in frequency for aviation, if the guy was correct. I did not get a chance to Google it as of yet. I want to Google it and see what I can find. I don't know how much power I'm supposed to put through this thing. I know when I put 100 watts to it, it does get a little warm. But being that I'm working Leos, you know, the time period is very narrow. So I'm not too worried about it.
Fantastic. Wow. Never would have predicted that. Boy, you feeling soft. You bid on it and won with $10. Out of curiosity, was there a buy it now price?
I don't know, because when I went on it, there was one bid on it of like $5. So if the guy had a buy-in bid on it, the bid of $5 would have took out the buy-in now price. My roll of the dice scheme on eBay is to wait until there's basically about 45 seconds left and then put in the amount that you're going to buy for. For argument's sake, about 4 weeks ago when I got this rig and I was putting up all my new antennas on the roof, I needed some new coax cable. This guy had a 259-foot roll. Okay, 259-foot, brand-new LMR 400 on a spool, never used. They used the rest of it. I guess it was a 500-foot spool. There was 259-foot left. And I waited till the end, and I got the whole thing. I think it was $18 shipping, and I ended up getting it for like, I think it was $15. The whole thing cost me like $33 for 259 feet of LMR 400.
Fantastic. Who is it just broken?
I don't want to give out my secrets to eBay here, you know what I mean? Like, everybody will be bidding against me with like 30 seconds left to get in my system here. KB2YEW5D.
Well done. Now, I bought 5 things from eBay in the last couple of months. When I finally find what I want on eBay, because of the projects I'm involved in, I got to have it yesterday. And in every one of those cases, I just pay the buy it now price. I probably could get the darn thing for half the price, but I wanted it yesterday. So I pay the buy it now price. And in every case, it arrives in fantastic shape and I'm happy. Boy, you want stuff these days. It's on eBay. And so, because we're all moving in that direction of online buying, whether it be Christmas, Hanukkah, just stuff you need, hardware or whatever, they've got it all. And as such, I guess our normal face-to-face flea markets are going to suffer a little bit, because eBay seems to have it all. Anybody want to make any comments on all the above? Give me your call letters and name right now. I heard somebody say something that I heard on the input, but I'm not hearing through the repeater. Say it again, sir.
You with a question?
Okay, KC2QIW, I think it is.
Yes. Yeah, what's the tone frequency number again? I'm looking through my owner's manual. Is it like, I have like so many different numbers on here, 67.0, and it goes all the way up to like 254.1.
Yeah, you want the one that is 136.5, 136.5 hertz, which is also called 4Z. QSL? That's amazing. That last transmission, I'm hearing you on the input, but not hearing you through the repeater. So somehow the repeater is rejecting whatever PO you're using right now, even though it thinks it's in the non-PO mode.